Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, the link between food and your mood, health scientist Tom Coleman on how to get good sleep in the summer months, and the ADHD coach Aoife Hughes on the most helpful training she says she has ever done, and she is bringing it to Ireland. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, I am good. All is well. And I wanted to give a mention to another project that I have been involved in. I may have touched on it as I was recording and working on it, but it's a podcast series for the DRCC. I'm going to be mindful in how I describe its content because of the earliness of the hour, but it is called Breaking the Silence. All six episodes of the series have now been released and are available on all podcast platforms at newstalk.com and on the Go Loud app. So the series aims to, as I suppose the title suggests, break the silence and the stigma around assault. And it's also an information source for anyone who has experience of it or wants to support another through it. I also think it's a topic for all of us to listen to, should we feel able, because obviously the nature of it can be triggering for some. But I do believe it is an every person issue as we push for change in our society and our systems, so that one day we don't need to have conversations like this anymore, or an organisation like the DRCC. I've received so many messages about it in my Instagram and through my email that I really wanted to give a mention to it. So many people commented on the strength of the survivors, who really did blow me away every time. Going into the project, I was conscious that I would have to be sensitive and mind them, which of course I did as they shared their story, but they were so strong. They really were turning what they had gone through into something to advocate so that others wouldn't go through it. And it was really special to witness and hold space for that. Obviously, people react to traumatic events differently, and not everybody has to become an activist or an advocate. All reactions are valid, but it was still very impressive to hear them and watch them use their voice. There is such power in conversation to shift our perceptions and to challenge beliefs, and I'm so proud to be part of that series. I was also with the DRCC recently when they released their annual statement at the Department of Justice, calling, as I say, for an Ireland where they no longer need to exist. If you do need their support, their national helpline is available 24 hours on 1-800-77-8888. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, and that series is called Breaking the Silence. Now, I've mentioned I have a gut health event coming up in Dublin on June 22nd, a Sunday. Go With Your Gut is on in Howth Castle. There'll be a hike, a hands-on cookery class of gut-friendly recipes in the gorgeous cookery school. There will be breathwork and wellness talks. I'm going to be joined on one of those talks by Mihaela Ivanchenko. She is a friend of mine and a psychotherapist with a huge interest in gut health. She and her husband Vali run Fermental, a fermented food business and cafe in Dublin. And Mihaela joins me on the line now. Mihaela, you're very welcome.
Hi. Hi, Claire. Hi.
Now, we have had many discussions about gut health, and indeed yourself and Vali were at the first ever Go With Your Gut Health event in the Morrison Hotel in Dublin a few years ago. But when did you first start to become interested in gut health?
Yeah, I think not long before that, a couple of years before that, when I decided to go to college. So I enrolled in the psychotherapy training and I was just buying books. And one of the books that I bought, just kind of almost randomly, is this book called The Psychobiotic Revolution by the professors in Cork, John Cryan and Ted Deanan. And that's where I learned about all these terms, the gut-brain connection, what is the microbiota, and the psychobiotic terms. And yeah, that's when I got interested in it.
And you are living here over 20 years, but in Romania, there is a lot more interest in fermented foods. Is that right? And we're getting new to them now, and they're showing up in our supermarkets. And, you know, there's a lot of interest in your cafe in Dublin and for your classes and workshops. But in Romania, that's a little bit more normal.
Yeah, we grew up with fermented foods. Every family, I suppose, preserves food, you know, in at the end of the summer. So that's a way of preserving. And those foods naturally have a probiotic element to them. So for us, it's something normal to eat fermented foods. And when I started my training and the pandemic, in the same time, we opened Fermental. And it's something that's just so normal to us, I suppose. We're trying to spread the awareness and offer it to everyone. So, yeah, we're bringing a part of our culture here.
And what are those links? You touched on some of them in the books you read, but you're going to get into it in more detail at the event and some of the things you learned. But can you give us a little headline about some of the latest research between our mood and the food we are eating?
Yeah, I got really interested, like I was saying, in the same time with opening Fermental, and by me and us eating more and more fermented foods. So I ended up writing my thesis in how the food, the role of nutrition basically in mental health. So the connection is through our vagus nerve that has a bidirectional way. So basically the gut communicates with the brain and the brain communicates with the gut. And the latest research, it's really exciting, really, really exciting. There's loads of research from the SMILE study to the Mediterranean studies. One of my favourite studies, and maybe because it's to do with fermented foods, is the Korean study that came out last year in 2024, where it shows that those consuming fermented foods had a lower depression and anxiety rates. So there is a huge correlation between what we eat and how we feel. Basically, the more plants and the more fermented foods we eat, the better we feel. And it's a great connection that I'm trying to bring it into my psychotherapy practice, and I'm trying to bring it into my life as well. So it's very exciting.
I love the findings of the SMILE project. Tell us a little bit about that piece of research.
The SMILE trial that came out in 2017, and that demonstrated that a Mediterranean diet, so basically loads of fresh fish and loads of fresh vegetables, olive oil, fruits and nuts, and maybe less meat and less processed food. Ultra processed foods. So that diet, including fermented foods, that showed to significantly reduce depression symptoms in participants with moderate to severe depression. So it's a great finding at the time. And there have been a lot more since, including the findings from University of Cork, which is one of the main lead researchers in the world when it comes to gut-brain connection and mental health.
Yeah, it's really exciting the work they're doing. And I've had them on the show a couple of times. It's great that Ireland is at the forefront of so much of this amazing research. And something I love about your work, Mihaela, is how this information is supposed to be empowering. Obviously, as a psychotherapist, you believe in therapy, in talk therapy, and that the approach and treatment is going to be multifaceted. This isn't about blame. This isn't about you caused how you feel by not eating right. This is supposed to be empowering, that we can impact our moods by the foods that we choose and have access to.
Yeah, exactly. So this is just, it's exciting because we all eat and we all have, well, arguably, you know, access to food. So this is just another tool that we have. So by choosing the right foods, we can support our mental health. So this is where I'm coming from. So it's really exciting to have another layer on top of, you know, medication, on top of talk therapy and all the other tools that we have to be able to feel good in our everyday life.
Yeah, I think it's such an important message. Well, you and I are going to be delving into this in more detail in the Library of Howth Castle, no less. It is Sunday, the 22nd of June. You can get tickets at howthcastlecookeryschool.ie, and you can find out more about Mihaela's work at Mihaela_therapy and at Fair Mental. Mihaela Ivanchenko, thank you very much for coming on. Right, coming up after the break, Tom Coleman on how to get the best sleep in the summer months. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, are you struggling to get a good night's sleep as the summer begins to kick in? Well, joining us for a deep dive into how we can get a better and a deeper sleep is health scientist and sleep expert Tom Coleman. Tom, you are very welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back. I'm exhausted. I think I haven't changed the summer duvet. That's number one. And I have a teenage son who will say to me at 11 o'clock, do you want to watch something, Mom? So I don't know how we can mitigate those. Well, the duvet I can do, the teenager maybe not. But do we sleep differently in the summer?
We do. Winter and summer habits tend to be different, and the drivers, the things that influence our sleep, can hugely impact in the summer. So we talk about, firstly, obviously, heat. So heat is critical. And the starting point for this is to understand your circadian biology, your body clock, and how temperature impacts sleep. So over your 24-hour cycle, life is full of cycles, wonderful, your core body temperature is at its peak at 5 p.m. It's at its lowest at 5 a.m., so in order to achieve sleep, your core body temperature and brain temperature have to drop by 1 degree centigrade, or nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so that's really influential. We have to align with that, work with that, and try and help that. Okay. The other thing that influences temperature is, well, what puts us to sleep? Melatonin. Okay, we've all heard of melatonin, the sleep hormone. And when melatonin is released, that causes vasodilation, opens up the blood vessels of peripherals, and that cools. Okay, so your melatonin is not just putting you to sleep, it's helping cool. So then we can look at light and how that influences.
Can I stay on temperature for one second? Because are men and women different? Because why are men more likely to sleep in their boxers and women are in like fluffy pennies, pyjamas and socks and all sorts?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's good, solid research there on sleeping naked, and there's many things that might influence that. Like it could be psychological safety. You know, that can influence whether I sleep naked or not. Like women's temperature, I mean, they have difficulty in variance due to the impact that estrogen has in the hypothalamus. So that's that keeps us in what we call homeostasis, or a normal state of functioning. So like obviously perimenopausal women and menopausal women, they experience huge disruption, hot flashes. Those are vasomotor symptoms, and that's caused by the role of estrogen in the temperature regulator in the brain. So there is great variance there with the hormones, and you know, I suppose I'm not sure if there's more men out there sleeping naked than there is women. But, you know, that has been shown to improve sleep. And look, temperature is huge in the bedroom. We talk about the environmental temperature, and then under the sheets. So there's something called temperature gradient. So the difference, right? Again, working with our biology, we want to try and cool the body down in the evening. And how do we do that? It's a little bit counterintuitive, but a warm shower. A warm or hot shower, that signals to the body there's a, you know, high temperature, cool, and it pushes blood flow out. It helps cool the core. The other thing you could do is have a warm foot bath. Okay, again, you're causing vasodilation of the extremities, which is cooling the core, which is going to help with sleep. The bedroom environment should be nice and cool, so keep it well ventilated throughout the day. Your fan, maybe if you have aircon, maybe if you don't. I've seen things about, like, not the hot water bottle, the cold water bottle. Okay, so sticking some cold water and ice cubes into your hot water bottle and chucking that at the end of your bed.
Wow! Yeah. I mean, I don't know if my head could get around that, but I do think it's important we look at our bedding, we look at what we're wearing at particular times of the year. At some point, wearing the winter PJs.
Yeah.
In the summer, I think now is a funny time because we're sort of doing the hokey cokey with the weather. One minute it feels like it's summer, and the next minute it seems to go back. But the temperature has definitely risen. So keeping the window open, keeping the bedroom cool and being conscious of that. And I like the top tip about the hot shower or the foot bath before bed.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the light then that you touched on there, because no matter how late I go to bed, ping, 5 o'clock in the morning, my eyes are open and ready to go, because we're very light sensitive, aren't we?
We're very light sensitive. We tend to, we more tend to wake up at the same time within our biology. You know, we kind of entrain the brain to do that. And like it or lump it, you're probably going to wake up at more or less the same time, unless you kind of drastically change things. So light is the master conductor. So everything that regulates sleep cycles and bodily functions that happen throughout the whole of the 24 hours is orchestrated by a region of your brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And that is informed by light. So we have very specific light receptors in our retina, in our eye. And that needs, I mean, I think it's kind of poetic and beautiful that we need photon light energy from a distant star to align our body. Isn't that amazing? You know, but that's the solid science of it. So different light receptors for different light frequencies. So morning light, your first light of the day is very impactful. The first thing that will do is that will clear the grogginess. That will clear adenosine, which is the grogginess you feel. And it's the fastest way to do it. Caffeine will also do it by blocking the receptor in the brain, but not as good. So your first light, also what your first light does is it sets a countdown timer for melatonin release of about 14 hours. Okay. The other thing it does is lots of light will increase your serotonin levels. Serene serotonin makes us feel happy in the present. We need more of that, you know, and less of the dopamine. But anyway, so lots of light will increase levels of serotonin in the brain. Now, serotonin is a precursor required to make the sleep hormone melatonin. So guess what? If you want to increase melatonin, get more light. Early in the day, throughout the day. And we need the white and blue light. We actually need it in the middle of the day and in the afternoon to keep everything aligned and to increase that serotonin. So light is huge. And then obviously, you know, late in the evening, we want to cut down those light impacts. And that's one of the reasons where sleep onset is maybe delayed, because it's brighter later. You know, I'm explaining to my six-year-old, he's like, but daddy, it's bright out, it's not time for bed, you know. And part of the brain is kind of like that as well, right? So, you know, try and control the environment and obviously get off the screens, but let's be clear about the screens here, right? People are like, oh, it's the blue and the white light. It's not. It's the activity you're doing on the screen. That's alerting the systems in the brain and dopamine and cortisol and all that. That's highly alerting, highly addictive. That's why you're awake. The light is kind of minimal in terms of the impact it has. And that's not according to me. That's according to Russell Foster in Oxford University, the head of neuroscience and circadian biologist. So our activities are crucial. I think you kind of alluded to it there, like, you know, your son going, do you want to watch this? Do you want, at 11 o'clock. We have to learn to work with our biology and wind down. It's our failure to wind down and not stimulate that's causing so many issues.
And are we supposed to sleep differently in the summer or try and stick to our routine? You know, we kind of hibernate a little bit in winter. It's dark at 4 o'clock. We crave different types of foods. In the summer, at 8 o'clock, you could head to the beach for a dip or a walk with your friend. You feel more energy, and even the foods you eat are different. Yeah. But does your sleep need to be the same?
We tend to sleep a little bit less. Like if we're looking at sort of population levels and circadian biology, we tend to sleep a little less in the summer. Yeah, so we tend to sleep a little more in the winter. The other habit that changes is going to bed and getting up. We tend to go to bed a little bit later in the winter and sleep later. And we tend to go to bed a little earlier in the summer and get up a little earlier, because the light is waking you up in the morning. That's how sensitive you are to light, is that one crack in the curtain can cause the Spanish Inquisition in the morning. Who put the curtains last night, you know? We're very sensitive to light. And that's where, like, a simple, low-tech, you know, eye mask. Get your eye mask. Like, that's, you know, that will improve your sleep the first night you wear it. Okay? So get a nice, comfortable eye mask. You know, there's lots out there. And you mentioned the bedding, very important. I also have a wool pillow, so it's not synthetic, and it's breathable, and it allows for temperature variance, you know. It dissipates heat, so fantastic. We want all of that environmental stuff to be right. So the linens, the cottons, the fresh sheets. We know what that feels like. Lovely fresh cotton sheets, you know. You go to a hotel or something, you're like, oh, lovely. So we want that kind of sensory stuff, you know, integrated into our bedroom as well.
And always the pillars come through again when it comes to your nutrition and moving your body. That really feeds into how you're going to sleep at night.
It does, because we often look at these things separately. Like I, as you know, do a lot of work in health and well-being, and my background is health science and physiology. And so all of these systems are integrated into one, which make us, you know, human. So like you cannot really separate them all out, because your food is really important. So thermoregulation, like you know, when your body breaks down food, it increases your body temperature. So if you're eating a big meal too late, not only is your digestive system active when it should be ramping down activity, but that increases thermoregulation. And the other signal to the body is, if I have a load of calories, well, it's time for action, right? I think it's really important to get the timing of the food right and the type of food right also. So tryptophan is an amino acid, and that's required to make serotonin and melatonin. So increasing tryptophan, foods high in tryptophan, can help. Because we do make a lot of melatonin in the gut. We make way more melatonin in the gut than we do in the pineal gland. Okay, so we have like two melatonin systems essentially. So food plays into that. Food plays into your ability to fall asleep. So if you have high carbohydrate foods, that will actually help sleep. Don't want people freaking out going, oh, carbs, late in the evening. You know, you get your calorie balance right. You get your exercise right. So the other thing that will influence, you know, your stress levels in many ways, and your temperature, is exercise. So if you can exercise in the afternoon, evening, it's a great time, you know, because again, your core body temperature is at its highest. You're least likely to injure. Your muscles are working well. Your cardio system is working well. So it is a good time to exercise. Also, what exercise does is it lowers nighttime secretion of cortisol. So why are people waking up? That's a good question. And often it's nighttime secretion of cortisol. So all of the hormones, and again, it's a 24-hour cycle. And it doesn't just stop. So we secrete tiny amounts. But if you're stressed out about work, or you have to remember this, or someone said something to you and upset you today, guess what? Your nighttime cortisol levels are going to increase. One of the ways to decrease those are exercise. Lower intensity later in the evening. So you're out for your long walk. Higher intensity is really good at reducing cortisol. It spikes them and then they drop below baseline levels. Foods can reduce cortisol. So things like pears, dark chocolate have been shown to reduce cortisol secretions at night. So they're all tied up. We treat them separately, but actually, and you know, like you know, Claire, like people who often come to me with sleep issues have lifestyle choice issues, have boundary issues. It's learning how to, you know, stop snacking. It's learning how to get off the screens, that kind of stuff. Like that's going to empower your sleep.
So just to remind us again then, your top tips for sleep in the summer.
Top tips for sleep in the summer is to be cognizant of working with your biology. So temperature is crucial. So it's like you tie up temperature and self-care together, you know. So you have that like ritual where you wash your face, you do your skincare, or you have a shower, or you have a foot bath, and if you put your pajamas on, you put your nightwear on, and your room is nice and cool, you have your eye mask there. Another good tip is to have like, and especially for those who wake up with hot flashes or stuff like that, put a little 500ml bottle of water into the freezer and wrap a face cloth in it, and have that then by your bed when it's frozen. The face cloth you can put around your neck, and that will cool your brain really good. But there's lots of little tricks like that you can do to keep yourself cool in the bedroom. So keep the bedroom ventilated, natural fibres, get the summer quilts out, maybe sleep naked, up to you. But, you know, that could really help. And, you know, it's the wind down. It's your full day, really. But, like, remember, temperature. What's my temperature and what's my activity level? And have a plan. If you're waking up at this time, or if heat is causing your wake up, and that could be causing the wake up too, heat build up. And often we attribute it to maybe something else. So look at your bedding, look at your environment, look at your activity.
And get yourself an eye mask. Definitely doing that. I want one of those big duvet type ones you can get around. It's definitely on the list and I'm going to make it happen now for the summer so I can catch those Z's as well as bond with my teenage son. If people want to find out more, you can go to tomcoleman.ie. Tom Coleman, thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Claire.
Coming up after the break, Aoife Hughes, the ADHD coach, on the most beneficial training she's ever done, and she's bringing it to Ireland later this year. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, my next guest, Aoife Hughes, is an accredited life coach. And following her late in life diagnosis with ADHD, she trained again to coach adults and parents of neurodivergent children through the challenge of navigating a neurotypical world. She's bringing a modality, Balaviz X, to Ireland, a training she says was her most beneficial and recommended to anyone in a caring or teaching environment. And Aoife joins me on the line now. Aoife, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Claire. How are you?
I'm very good. Aoife, you and I have spoken before. Indeed, you've been a great support in my life, parenting a child with ADHD through your work. And you have joined me on Lunchtime Live before. But will you tell my lovely listeners here on Alive and Kicking your story? It was you starting in teaching that led eventually to you becoming the ADHD coach.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks so much for having me on, Claire. So I was a teacher for many years and I loved my job. But as the more I get into my career and with another colleague of mine, we realised that we weren't trained to support the mental health challenges that we were presented with in the classroom. And so that led to a passion and hyper-focused learning on how we can, learn those skills for ourselves because we've never been taught them before. And then B, impart them to our students and the wider school community. And so the more I learned about that, the more I realized how much there was a lot of resistance to it within the education sector from the powers that be mainly. And there was a real lack of understanding of the link between children being anxious or traumatized or, you know, being dysregulated and how they physically cannot learn when their brains are not in the state that they need to be, which is their prefrontal cortex, their executive state. So the more immersed I became in that, the more passionate I became about mental health. And then as a side to that, my husband is a doctor. When I met him, he was an engineer. He went back to medicine. And so that brought us on a trip literally around Ireland and eventually over to America. The education system is not set up for moving. I had my permanent pensionable job in a great school, great kids in Dublin's inner city. And unfortunately, I had to move schools and jobs. And so my undiagnosed neurodivergent brain just really struggled with the change. And then the more schools I worked in, the more I realized where mental health really isn't being prioritized. And we're doing such a disservice to our students and also the teachers. You know, teachers are being told what to do. They have to follow a curriculum. You know, it's very much the powers that be, the board of management and the principals. And mostly it's the Department of Education. You know, so teachers are doing what they're told. And so I just got more and more frustrated. I was probably quite vocal about my frustration and my worry and my apprehension and my fear. And also myself and my colleague, we were propelled by the response we'd get from students. Like, kids are incredible and they're wise beyond their years. And they would learn this content and implement it really quickly and really easily because they're not as conditioned as we are. However, when the adults around them aren't implementing the same language, then it acts as a huge barrier. And so they're eventually going to forget it all. So that wasn't the case everywhere we went, but in most of the places it was. And so the more I tried to fight against the system, the more burnt out I became. And the more we moved, the more my mental health was challenged. And then COVID hit and we had a couple of losses in our family. And so my therapist, who I worked with for 8 months, had a light bulb moment one day. And, you know, she asked me, had I ever been assessed? And that's all she said. So it was from there then that I sought out an assessment, got my diagnosis in 2021, 3 to 4 months before I actually finished up teaching. And it wasn't until we were in America and I was decompressing because I wasn't allowed to work. I told my husband, I can't do it anymore. I can't teach. I'm burnt out. I mean, I wasn't doing myself any favors trying to fight a system that's not listening. And so I discovered ADHD coaching and first immersed myself in learning about ADHD so I could do that for myself on a personal level. And then I took a break for a while and then did my cert in life coaching. And then because of my parenting hat, my teaching hat, my mental health education hat, my own neurodivergent hat, it just really lent itself to being able to support my clients. So I work with adults and parents of ADHD children.
I want to ask you about getting a diagnosis later in life, because obviously that's something that's happening a lot more. Is it always a positive thing for people to get that retrospective understanding of themselves and their experience of the world?
That hasn't been my experience with my clients. No, for many of them, it's really difficult. They're really glad that they know, but there's a huge wave of grief that comes with it. And if you, like, we live in a country where we're not taught how to manage our emotions or understand our emotions. So, you know, there's all this toxic positivity and masculinity and all this shame around not being able to achieve certain grades and, you know, reaching certain heights. And so for many people, without that support, without professional support and a real deeper understanding of themselves, getting the ADHD diagnosis can be a relief, but it can then equally be, well, what do I do with this now? Because so many people will put all of their time and energy using their executive function to get the diagnosis. And then there's this like, oh my God, yay, this is amazing. And then, you know, a week later, it's like, well, what do I do with this now? What does this mean? And I think for so many people, that can be really, really difficult. And it's not until they reach a crisis point that that's when they'll reach out for the support. And again, a lot of that is because there's very much an eye-rolling approach to ADHD diagnosis, especially within the adult community. It's like, oh, there's another one. So that can act as a barrier to sharing with people, to reaching out, to asking for support. I know some of my clients have worked with therapists or other support services that are not neuroaffirming, so they're not supporting them and understanding of them, of their brain and working with their brain and acceptance of how their brains work. And so that can be quite damaging. And all it takes is one wrong person for a person to decide, no, I'm not going to go down this route. Now, on the flip side of that, you know, for many people, and it was for me, it was extremely cathartic and it was a relief. And it was almost like I was up in an attic, found a mirror, and I'd been looking at it my whole life, but there was this massive layer of dust on it. And so getting that diagnosis for me was like actually taking away the dust and go, oh, there she is. There's Aoife.
I love that analogy. That's gorgeous. And there's so many misconceptions and misunderstanding and lack of knowledge around ADHD. So what is it and what isn't it?
Well, it's not a trend. It's very real. I like to quote two of the leaders in the field. One of them is Russell Barkley and one of them is Ed Halliwell. Ed Halliwell describes ADHD as our brains are like Ferrari brains with bicycle brakes. So that's a lovely, easy, you know, analogy to get our head around. Russell Barkley then, he talks about ADHDers as having difficulty with seven elements in their lives. I might not remember them all now, Claire, but I'll do my best. My whole brain is playing up. But it's self-awareness, regulation, impulsivity, memory, problem-solving, and hyperactivity. And I know there's other ones as well, and I'm really sorry, I can't remember them.
I think you got to six there. I'm going to congratulate you there. That's pretty good. I couldn't tell you what I had for breakfast, so carry on.
So when you see what ADHD is, and so many people think it's, you know, obviously it's characterized by three core elements, which are challenges with inattentiveness, hyperactivity, and impulsivity. But there are so many layers beneath that people don't realize. And that's a lot of the work I do with my adult clients and my parent clients, because the word I hear that comes before ADHD really often is just, sure, it's just ADHD. And that word, oh, if I could throw it out the window, I would. But it diminishes all of our experience of what ADHD is, how debilitating it can be, and also how powerful it can be. I don't like the term superpower, but there are so many strengths to do with having ADHD. But if you don't know how to, if you don't understand ADHD on a very deep level, then it's really hard to harness the strengths, but they are 100% there. And so that's the work I love to do with my clients, whether they're adults or parents of children, is first of all, well, do you know what ADHD is? This is what it is. And so when they develop that understanding, I mean, it's just a game changer. And then they can, you know, especially for the adult clients, is then they can go back to their childhood and realize, you know, it wasn't little Aoife's fault that she didn't know all of this, or the people around her didn't know all of this. It wasn't little John's fault or little Claire's fault. You know, there is a reason why the struggles have been the way they have, or why you've thrived in areas and you could never make sense. Like, I directed two musicals, I choreographed a flash dance, and I had no training. I mean, where does that come from? My ADHD brain. And that's awesome. And it's great to now know that that's where it came from. But sure, I didn't have a clue at the time. I was just, you know, following what I loved, which ADHDers are great at. They're following their creativity, following their intuition and their instinct. But because a lot of our challenges manifest as quote unquote bad behavior, we're constantly being hit with a barrage of really negative comments, 20,000 more, in fact, than our peers by the time we're age 12. So you can imagine the impact that has on our confidence, on our self-esteem and our self-belief.
Yeah, and that's been one of my biggest bugbears as a parent of a child with ADHD. I wanted to get him the diagnosis, obviously, so he could understand himself. I didn't want him looking in a dusty mirror. And I also wanted to make sure I could get him the supports that he needs. But I often hear the analogy of the square peg in a round hole when it comes to the education system. And that's my biggest worry, that kids with any neurodivergent diagnosis come out the other side of the education system thinking they're not enough and they can't. And that's no way to start life.
Absolutely. And the missing piece, and I learned it myself, is education. Education, education, education. And it doesn't have to be that hard. And I repeat this, whoever anybody's listening to talk to, like, you know, whoever I get to talk to, it's, you know, it's what I learned when we developed the mental health education program. It's like, oh my God, all of this information is out there. You know, why are they not getting this? How can we have politicians in service who are not brain aware, who are not trauma informed and who are not neuroaffirming? Not to mention all the other areas in their, you know, in our society that they should have training in. And it's the same in schools. Like, I was a teacher, Claire, for 20 years. I loved my job. I specialised in working with children, with neurodivergent children in the latter part of my career for 7 years. And it wasn't until I did my training with the ADD Coach Academy in America, that's when I learned about ADHD. And I was like, OMG. Like, okay, I know I did the best I could with what I had. And that's the problem. So many teachers are, you know, they're supporting themselves. They're trying to get all the information they can to try and support the kids, you know, that they can as best they can. And there's only so much teachers can do. Like, as it is, I mean, I had to leave. I was so burnt out and I was so broken. And that was a privilege. I was able to. But I know so many teachers who can't and they don't have that choice. Yeah. And they love their job. They don't want to leave.
Yeah, but if you're not trained in neurodivergence, then how can you properly support it and not become burnt out? There is perhaps a glimmer of hope. We're not going to be able to solve it all in one conversation today. No. But you are bringing training here to Ireland that you say was one of the best things you have ever trained in. Tell us a bit about it.
Rhythm and music are amazing regulatory tools to bring into the classroom. And so I went on the hunt and I came across this program, which is called BALAVIS-X, and it stands for Balance Auditory and Vision Exercises. So once I started reading about it, I was intrigued and it was incredible. So on a personal level, my brain was so sharp, I can't describe it. So the program itself is is a multi-sensory and rhythmical whole brain integration program. And it requires simultaneous engagement of balance, auditory processing and visual tracking. And the late Bill Hubert, who developed it, he developed this over 40 years ago, by the way, and it is all over the world. And they've never used social media. They use it very lightly lately, but it's all through word of mouth. Anything related to the brain, this program is incredible. And the fabulous thing about it is it's so accessible. And when, as a teacher, right, every teacher is stressed or is stretched in the country and the SNAs. And so what I started doing is I started, you can integrate this program into whether you're, like, I'm an ADHD coach now, so I integrate it with my clients that I work with in person, or I integrated it as a SEND teacher with my students. And you can integrate it into the classroom as well. And what it did for my students, it was just incredible to see in a short amount of time. So what I love about this is that it's rooted in rhythm. So it's like physical meditation. So you're moving your body and you're using these sandbags and these racquetballs. It's that rhythm and they're very precise movements that are crossing the midline. And they this bilateral coordination is believed to strengthen neural pathways between the two hemispheres of the brain. And so over the years, it's, you know, people have found improvement in underlying cognitive functions like visual processing and auditory discrimination and working memory. And I can attest to it both on a personal and on a professional level.
It's such a testament to how we should be learning, that it's not just sitting and listening and regurgitating, that there should be other ways that we harness the power of how the mind and the brain works and the connection between the mind, the body and the spirit. We will have to leave it there. The training is later in the year, the 10th to the 12th of October, but you're recommending it. It sounds like everybody could benefit, but particularly parents, caregivers or those teaching children or, you know, adults in a learning environment. For more on Aoife's work and to find out about that Balaviz X training, you can go to aoifehughescoaching.com. Aoife Hughes, the ADHD coach, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much, Claire.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.